Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Hello, and here's a war story, quite appropriate for the day after Veterans Day. It's entitled, Wake Me When It's Over. What better place than Spain for a nap and a bus ride? This was sent in by Carl Smith. I was a submarine sailor during most of my 24-year Navy career, along with a few service schools and 5 years of shore staff duty assignments that did not involve submarines. After spending 3 months on a diesel sub following submarine school and another school, I was assigned to the Fleet Ballistic Missile, the FBM submarine, USS Sam Rayburn, SSBN 635. The Gold Crew as a junior missile technician. Those 41 for Freedom submarines each carried 2 complete crews, a blue and a gold. The subs were called 41 for Freedom because there were 41 of them. When in operation, one crew had the ship for an approximate 1 month upkeep period and an approximate 2.5 months deterrent submerged patrol. In about 1966, during one of our pre-patrol upkeeps in Rota, Spain, on the Sam Rayburn, an opportunity came up to join a few of the guys on an overnight trip to Torremolinos, Spain. The trip was sponsored by the base and the ship, and the cost was cheap enough. The biggest problem was arranging the time off. To get 2 days and nights off together meant begging someone to stand extra duty nights, as well as leaving your gang short a man or two during the daytime. Money changed hands, too, or the promise of a like favor next time around for the other guy. Anyway, I arranged it and joined 15 to 20 guys on an old bus for the trip up the Spanish Gold Coast, Costa del Sol, past Gibraltar toward Malaga. It was probably 150 miles or more and took hours to get there. On arrival, we were dropped at our hotel, Hotel Blason, and were told where the bus would pick us up the next day to go home promptly at noon. My roommate for the night was another missile tech named DJ Johnson. We checked in, stored our gear, and headed out for a snack. Tickets to an evening floor show were included with the hotel reservations and the bus ride. After our snack, DJ and I joined some of the other guys at the first place we came to. I ordered a drink, and when it came, it was about the size of a giant iced tea. I finally finished it and ordered another. After a couple of drinks, DJ and I decided to go back to the room to take a nap before supper and the show. We left word at the desk to wake us up at a certain time. We hadn't been in town 2 hours yet. I remember someone waking us and DJ getting up and trying to get me up. I told him to go on without me. The next thing I remember, it was the next morning, Sunday, and it was around 11 a.m. We had less than an hour to get cleaned up, dress, eat, shop, and get to the bus on time. We were running to make it after an all-too-brief bite to eat. I had just enough time to pop into the only souvenir shop that seemed to be open. The only thing I bought was a chrome match dispenser. We got on the bus and were soon away. We spent more hours hungover, hungry, and tired before getting back to the base at Rota and back aboard ship. I'd been gone 2 workdays and 1 night, and I hadn't had a full meal the whole time we were gone. I had 1 souvenir to show from my excursion. I missed the floor show, and I was going to be paying someone back with extra duty for all the, quote, fun I had. It wasn't quite the outcome I had envisioned. This was Wake Me When It's Over by Carl Smith. This next story is from the Good Old Days on Wheels section of the Good Old Days magazine. It's entitled, My Love of Motorcycles. He preferred the two-wheel way to get around. And this was sent in by Lowell Holmgren. In 1943, I was 12 years old, and World War II was well underway. Gasoline and most everything else was rationed. My father was very patriotic. To cut down on gasoline use, he bought a Cushman motor scooter. It got about 60 miles per gallon. His Buick only got 12. I was in the driveway the day the scooter was delivered, and I thought it was the most beautiful machine I had ever seen. My father was a businessman and always wore a 3-piece suit with a white shirt and tie. The next morning after the scooter was delivered, I watched him ride off to work on it, wishing it was me riding that wonderful machine. That afternoon, when he came home, I was right there waiting for him. He parked the scooter, got off, and backed away from it. He looked at it and then turned to me and said, "From now on, that thing belongs to you." And he went into the house. I was thunderstruck, speechless with joy. I never found out what had happened to him, and I didn't care. I rode that thing for about 3 years, to school, to scout meetings, delivering papers, and so forth. I loved every minute and mile. Then one day, I apparently did something wrong, and Dad took it away from me. I never saw it again. I had a nice Schwinn bicycle. I took it to a machine shop and had a flat steel plate welded to the frame just above the pedal hub. I bolted a 1-horsepower Briggs & Stratton engine on the plate, hooked it up to the back wheel with a V-belt, pulleys, sprockets, and chain, and I had a motorbike. It had direct drive, which means no clutch, and I had to push it to start it. When the engine fired, I jumped on and away I went. It had a top speed of about 25 miles per hour. 4 or 5 of my friends had similar machines, and we made quite a gang, charging around and bending the rules of the road. We never got stopped for speeding. We couldn't go that fast. There were 2 city police officers, Thelbert Mahon and Ralph Raitz, who gently kept us within due bounds. I rode that bike to high school, 2 miles each way, in all kinds of weather. When there was snow and ice on the streets, I took an occasional spill, but nothing serious. One summer day, my friend Ed and I were riding around the streets near home, and I was showing off my great skill by riding with my feet cocked up on the crash bars, hands clasped over my knees, no hands on the handlebars. Ed pulled up beside me and accidentally touched my left handlebar. That jerked the front wheel, threw me off balance, and suddenly I was sitting in the same position on the street, while the bike had righted itself and was proceeding down the street without me. Now I was not only sitting there, I was sliding at about 15 miles per hour, and the pavement was not smooth like glass. Very quickly, the seat of my jeans and the seat of my undershorts were gone, and I was sliding down the street on my bare rear end. Ed came back and helped me up and walked me home about 3 blocks. I was in some pain, and my rear was a bloody mess. I lay across the closed toilet seat while Ed washed and applied half a can of Band-Aids to my injuries. In the meantime, my bike had traveled half a block down the road and angled off through the ditch into a building site where a hole had been dug for a basement. You guessed it, that's where the bike went. We found it there and dragged it up and out. Fortunately, it was not hurt nearly so bad as I was. A few years later, I had a part-time job. I was feeling flush with cash and decided I wanted to move up in the world, so I bought a new Royal Enfield motorcycle. It had a 1-cylinder, 2-cycle gas engine that required me to add a measure of 60-weight motor oil to every tank of gas. I enjoyed riding that bike, but didn't take very good care of it, and after a couple of years, the engine blew and it disappeared. Then, for some unknown reason, I shifted to automobiles. That led to girls, and that led to marriage. We got very busy building a house and raising a family. We had 5 fantastic children, 4 of whom survived and have blessed me with grandchildren and great-grandchildren. We divorced after 24 years. During all those years, I had no motorcycles. Eventually, I remarried, and it turned out my second wife, Dee, enjoyed riding motorcycles as a passenger behind me. So I got a 1983 Honda 800. It had a 4-cylinder fluid drive and no clutch. We enjoyed riding that bike, but it was not a long-distance highway bike. After a few years, I bought my first Gold Wing. I believe it was a 1993 1100cc 4-cylinder. It had nice padded bucket seats. Now we can enjoy riding farther afield. We found that the Black Hills of western South Dakota are ideal. There are hundreds of miles of winding roads through pine-clad hills. We spent many weekend days exploring all these byways. After a while, I got itchy feet again. I traded those 2 bikes for a newer Gold Wing. This baby was the Cadillac of motorcycles. 6 cylinders, 1300cc, 5-speed transmission, electric starter, cruise control, AM/FM radio, CB radio, stereo speakers on the dash, and earphones and microphones in the helmets. Not to mention, it had very comfortable bucket seats. We rode that machine all over the country. Seattle, Denver, Minneapolis, Duluth, and many places in between. We belonged to several fraternal groups and attended state and national conventions. After many years of enjoyment, in my late 70s, I finally hung up my helmet and quit riding. My son got the Gold Wing. Now I'm 93, and I don't drive or even own any kind of a motor vehicle. My short-term memory can be a bit spotty, but my head is chock full of wonderful memories of the good old days. This is My Love of Motorcycles by Lowell C. Holmgren. This next story is entitled Bean Boots. He knew this package was worth the wait. This is written by James Pendleton. Lewis pulled the old Chevy van up to our house after school, and my brothers and I got out. My feet were wet, as they often were that fall, but it was with excitement and anticipation that I went running into the house. "Did my boots come today, Mom?" It was late in the fall of 1943. The war had been going on for nearly 2 years. I was nearly 12. Footwear was rationed and very difficult to get, particularly rubber boots of any kind. On dry days, I wore my shoes, and on wet days, a pair of rubber packs that a neighbor had given to me. They were hand-me-downs from one of his sons, who was considerably older than I was. The boots were at least two sizes too big for me. Those rubber packs had seen their day. The sole was broken on both boots. It was necessary to mend the breaks in the soles with a rubber composition material called Solo. I would clean the breaks, apply rubber cement, and when properly tacky, force the gooey Solo into the breaks and then let it harden overnight. The repair would last a couple of weeks, and then we needed to do it again. Obviously, the boots would be wet and would require a couple days of drying time on top of the warming closet over the wood stove. The old Solo would have to be pulled out, and then the area would have to be cleaned, cemented, and patched all over again. In the meantime, I'd wear my regular shoes and hope it wouldn't rain or snow. My parents cautioned me that there was no guarantee I'd get the boots at all. A lot of people needed them. There could be a 6-week to 2-month shipping delay. The boots cost $4.65 a pair. I had saved about $3 from my summer earnings from caddying at the golf course, and Mom and Dad agreed to pay the rest. Bean's catalog didn't have children's sizes, only men's sizes. That meant the smallest size I could buy was a size 6. My shoe size at the time was only 4. We ordered the boots as soon as we could in hopes that I would stand a better chance of getting them. Days went by. Each school day I'd pick my way around puddles or trudge through the snow with whatever I had for shoes or boots that day. In the afternoon, we'd all climb out of the Chevy carry-all van that served as our school bus, and I would hurry into the house. My question was always the same. Poor Mom must have found it difficult to answer the question day after day with a no. Christmas was rapidly approaching, and with it came more snow and more frequent wet feet. Needless to say, my hopes were low that the boots would ever arrive at all. After one particularly long day, we boarded the van to head home. It stopped at our house, and I got out and trudged to the back door. Mom met me with a package from Freeport, Maine. I opened the package carefully. The boots might not be the right size. I might need the packing slip so we could return them. I got my shoes off and hauled on the boots. Bean boots could be pulled on because they had a leather loop in the back just for that purpose. My feet floated in them, as they were two sizes too large. Well, I could always wear extra socks, and my feet would grow. We did not return the boots. I'm sure L.L. Bean sold many boots before that day in late 1943, and many since. I dare to say they never sold a pair any more beautiful or any more appreciated than mine. This was Bean Boots by James Pendleton. This next story is entitled Prisoner of Love. It took a while for her hero to return to the brother she knew. This was sent in by Cindy Hargash. I will never forget holding my dad's hand and waving feverishly with the other as I watched my brother Larry walk away and melt into a sea of green at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. When I lost sight of him, I asked my dad, "Where is Vietnam anyway?" He didn't answer, but that didn't stop my 10-year-old mind from wondering out loud, "Do you think soldiers get scared?" "Of course they do," Dad said. As Larry's first Christmas away from home drew near, I prayed he would return to our Merrillville, Indiana home, where everyone trimmed their windows with garland and festive lights. At the same time, ours was decorated with a single blue star service flag, reminding others that we had loved ones at war. Besides my bedtime prayers, I upped my chances by including a wish on a lucky ceramic figurine. I wish Larry would come home for Christmas, but if he can't, I hope he's not sad. Thank heavens Larry returned home a year later, and it seemed all my prayers and wishes had been answered by Christmas 1969. All that is, except one. Something strange happened while he was gone, something so terrible that even our mom's homemade fudge or warm apple dumplings couldn't fix it. The scent of a fresh-cut pine tree draped with strands of silver tinsel and colored bulbs the size of walnuts couldn't stop the humbug from invading our house. Sadly, my big brother had been sent off to war, but a stranger had returned in his place. Larry had lost his smile and the good-natured ribbing he gave to his sisters. So I waited for my brother to feel better as he sat behind closed doors and in quiet corners. On Christmas Eve, long after everyone had gone to bed, our house grew so still that the old furnace vents amplified the sound of rustling paper. After tracking the noise, I found Larry under the warm glow of tree lights, rifling around for packages with his name. "I won't tell if you shake one," I said, letting him know he'd been caught. "You're still the little pest I remembered," Larry shot back. "Am not." "R2," he teased. Then gathering his presents, he tiptoed down our wooden hallway and disappeared into his bedroom. At last, my obnoxious brother, the one I loved and remembered fondly, had shown up to harass me. I wanted to spend as much Christmas wonder with Larry before he stopped being himself again. "Can I come in?" "No, go to bed." "But I can't sleep," I whispered into the lit space below his closed door. Slowly the door opened, and Larry's 6'2" frame towered over me. "You can come in as long as you're quiet." Though Larry's eagerness to burst into Christmas early would disappoint the family, I felt privileged to watch him open his long-awaited gifts. He opened each one with as much stealth and precision as a cat burglar. After learning the contents, He rewrapped them, carefully replacing taped edges so no one would suspect prior snooping. Eventually, he reached for the only present left, a crumpled, sloppily wrapped bit of nothing. After realizing how childish it looked, I shrank in embarrassment. "Not that one," I begged, and ran off to bed. On Christmas morning, everything had been put back beneath the tree. Keeping his secret, I watched Larry reopen his presents with the same anticipation he had a few hours earlier. Once again, he saved my slipshod gift for last. The one I had wound up like a toilet paper roll and bound with nearly an entire spool of tape and red ribbon. "What's this?" he asked, hinting that he had saved the unveiling until that moment instead of opening it early. When he reached the end of the wrappings, he found a note from me and a 5-inch Inesco doll figurine painted in prison stripes that bore the sign Prisoner of Love. It had a pouty face, red feathery hair, and a ball and chain attached to its ankle. Larry silently read the handwritten note. "Larry, I prayed and wished for you to come home every night. I kept this good luck doll next to my bed, but you can have it. If you wish hard enough, you can be happy again. Love, Cindy." My cheeks burned like hot coals until I saw a smile tug at the corner of his mouth. My grown-up brother stuffed the doll into his front shirt pocket like a piece of found treasure and whispered, "Thanks." Then, while rubbing his knuckles back and forth over the top of my head until my hairs stood on end, he teased, "Knucklehead, am not, R2. Larry finally released a belly laugh, making it the best Christmas ever. Thanks for listening to this reminiscing show on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you a good afternoon and good memories.